And in case you're not familiar with the Billy Meier situation, or you are, well, either way, you're going to be certainly interested, I believe, in this program. One little note before we begin, and I've got a link on the website for this because I thought it was so completely incredible. It's breaking news, really, entitled Antarctica, Lost World Found. Antarctica. Two teams of researchers, and by the way, so you know this came, it's on the CNN page, two teams of researchers working separately, thousands of miles from each other, but both defeating incredible odds, have really made some incredible finds in frozen Antarctica. So stunning that the National Science Foundation calls their discoveries evidence of a lost world. The researchers found what they believe to be the fossilized remains of two species of dinosaurs previously unknown to science. One, a 70-million-year-old quick-moving meat-eater found on the bottom of an Antarctic sea, while the other is a 200-million-year-old plant-eater that was found on top of a mountain in the Antarctic. Now, this is pretty strange stuff. I'll tell you, pretty strange stuff in Antarctica of all places. Now, the lost world in which these two dinosaurs lived was very different from the Antarctica we know now. Their Antarctica was not frigid and frozen. Their Antarctica was warm and wet. And if you would like to take a little ride up to the coasttocoastam.com website, you can read the entire article. But I thought that was worthy of your attention. In the meantime, after 25 years of research, Michael Horn is now, officially, the authorized American media representative for the Billy Meier Contacts. Michael's background is quite eclectic. He is a trend-setting designer, award-winning painter and songwriter, one of the first inventors of online digital book publishing, the creator of the medically endorsed Sit and Get Fit regenerative movement program and videos, and music and video producer. His new DVD on the Meier Contacts is available from, and we'll get to that, so hang in there. At any rate, in a moment, we will discuss in detail the incredible case in Switzerland of Billy Meier. Stay right there. Of all the UFO cases in the world, in the history of the world, really, I think perhaps the Billy Meier case is the most famous, maybe one of the most contested, one of the most controversial, no question about it, in the world. Michael Horn, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Art. A pleasure to be here.
Hey, Michael, with a background like yours, which is kind of in, you know, it's in the media for sure, but I mean songwriter, book publishing, regenerative sit and get fit movements, that kind of thing. How do you get from there to Billy Meier?
I think I got from Billy Meier to some of those places. Well, what happened was in 1979, I had been living in L.A. for about 9 years. At that point, I went into a bookstore called the Bodhi Tree, and I saw the first coffee table size picture book, if you will. It also had text, but mainly the beautiful pictures of the UFOs. And ever since I was a kid, I had dreams of lights in the sky and fascination with spaceships and that type of thing, like probably many other people. So when I saw the book, it resonated. It looked like it was real. Of course, I don't base my current position on how I felt simply looking at the pictures, but they were the most astounding photographs I'd ever seen of so-called UFOs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Billy Meier photographs, for those who have not seen them, are the most detailed, close-up, in many cases, totally clear, not blurry shots of UFOs, alleged UFOs, I guess I ought to say,
sure,
in the world. As simple as that. They're very, very clear photographs. So now, let's go back, and if you would, just for me, for everybody, Michael, tell us the story of Billy Meier. Who is Billy Meier? How did all this happen? When?
Sure.
Usual what, where, when?
Sure, I'll try and give you the kind of condensed overview. Billy Meier is a Swiss man who claims that his voluntary and face-to-face contacts with extraterrestrial humans started when he was 5 years old. He and his father had allegedly seen a silver-type object fly overhead. This was in about 1942 or so. He asked his father what it was. His dad says, "I don't know, but I think it may be a weapon that Hitler's developing, et cetera, et cetera."
Uh-huh. They were farmers, weren't they?
They were always living in a very rural area, a small village, and to this day, Meyer lives in a small, very small rural environment in what's called the Schmittruti or Hinterschmittruti in Switzerland, outside of Zurich by perhaps 40 miles or more. And then one day, you know, having all of this great rural environment in which to grow up, he spent a lot of time in fields and forests, and one day he was outside in the forest, and he felt a kind of, he said it was like a calling, like somebody calling to him. Mm. He heard it inside of his head, and so he followed it, and there was a pear-shaped craft with an elderly-looking man in what he said looked like a deep-sea diver's suit standing there, and as he tells it, he said he felt no fear. He felt that this was a kind person. He felt safe, and he went and, you know, walked up to the man, and that began these contacts where he was, you know, taken on board this craft with this man. Sometimes...
Okay, you say this man.
Whose name was Svath. That may not help matters, but he was called Svath. I believe that was spelled S-F-A-T-H. That's how it's kind of written and pronounced in the...
All right, but a man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not a little gray guy, a fully... human-looking human being. It would pass for an elderly-looking European man.
Hmm.
So all of the people that Meyer has his major contacts with are human beings.
All right. I need to ask, for the sake of the audience and myself, how you know this. In other words, did you interview Billy Meyer?
Well, I've spoken with Billy any number of times, but I think you've just brought up a really good point that I want to put out in the beginning here. There's two categories of information. One of them is speculative, meaning I can tell you the story as I know it.
Yes.
And the other part is I can tell you the facts as I've been able to determine them. And even so, you should, meaning anybody listening who would want to, take a, take a good look at the material that's available and find out for yourself if it rings true. Do the same thing I did. Do the research. And we can talk more about how I did that, but that's a good caveat. I'm going to...
Well, I would appreciate it if, as we go along, you would delineate between
speculation
and what you know to be fact.
Absolutely. So what I'm going to tell you now is the story as it is written in the Meyer material of Billy's contacts and how they progressed. This is not my experience. It's available. Anybody could read it and tell you the same story up to a certain point here. So Billy was allegedly then having these contacts with this human being, and they lasted for a couple of years. Meyer didn't tell his own family. He didn't feel that he could really confide this, but he did tell a parish priest, a Father Zimmerman, who assured him, for some reason, this man felt like it was perfectly good that this was happening to Billy, and he should not be troubled by it, and that these were good people. Somehow this man, Zimmerman, may have in his own way either been a contactee in person or telepathically. That's the sense of this part of the story.
You wouldn't think a priest would give advice of that sort.
You would not at all. And that's why, you know, it is noted in the material that this was very unusual. And, Billy took comfort in that as a boy, because he did have then a kind of neighborly confidant to explain this to and to get encouragement from. And apparently what we are told is that this man, Svath, not only told Billy and taught him things in an oral tradition, but he put devices on his head that Billy said looked like different things that had wires he didn't understand, but they were apparently working on his brain and his thinking and inputting information into him. And again, this is the speculative part. So he's told that when he's about 7 years old, that he has the thinking capacity of a 35-year-old man. Now, this was not something that made him, these experiences didn't make him more adaptable and more comfortable in his own environment, in schools and what have you. As a matter of fact, from what the material is, I recall, and I haven't read this part for some time, but it caused him to be troubled and to be a bit of a misfit, and I think he even ended up in some kind of juvenile schools. And he's had an enormously varied and challenging life, and he's kind of done it all. French Foreign Legion, but it none of it's been a bed of roses. It's all been extremely challenging conflicts brought on by these experiences and the you know, and of course the derision and assault on his character and his person that has occurred ever since he went public with his story.
Yes. There's been a lot of that, and we will discuss that. But
oh, yeah.
At this stage, did Billy say what they were inculcating in him, what they were telling him, what kind of information he was getting? What does he know about that?
Well, what I recall, and I'm not sure that I'm going to recall it all accurately, he did say that they were telling him things that had to do with future times, with vast amounts of information pertaining to different subjects, and things that he would be able to access and have, you know, some conscious control over and recall later on at more appropriate times in his life. Hmm. That this was kind of, you know, maybe it's the equivalent of, you know, downloading stuff into a computer for when you're ready to use it.
Mm-hmm.
But he said that, you know, there would be things that would come to him when he needed to know them, and then also that they would, throughout their contacts with him, that they would help him become aware of and adjust to things. And they said to him, even at an early age, that this was something that he had agreed to do on a certain level prior to his, you know, coming into this life. And he knows that at these points, initially these things didn't make much sense to him, but he was not threatened by these people. He felt very comfortable with them to the degree that they felt familiar.
Okay, who are these people?
Well, what we're told are that they are people who we now are told are called Pleiaren, spelled P-L-E-J-A-R-E-N.
Not Pleiadians.
For the longest time, that's how we had come to know of, you know, these so-called extraterrestrials.
When did you get that clarification?
I believe Billy was in 1995 at the point that they were about to officially depart and close up their bases that they had on the planet. They told him that he could now reveal the, you know, this discrepancy and why it was put in place.
Okay, let's hear the real name again, please.
Pleiaren.
Pleiaren.
Yeah, so the J is a Y or an I kind of a sound. Pleiaren. The Pleiades would be also spelled with a J. And what they said was, yes, we come from a system in the direction of the Pleiades in an altered time-space configuration because the stars that you see in the skies, the Pleiades, cannot support life. These are young blue suns, etc. And anybody that claims on any level that they're in touch with so-called Pleiadians is hoaxing. So what they claim that they did here was this. They claim that they put this in motion using this term Pleiadians so that for those who would come after Billy, supposedly, and claim to be having contacts with Pleiadians and channeling Pleiadians and all of the rest of this stuff, that they would be self-identifying as hoaxers because there are no Pleiadians. So this is, you know, another one of those little bumps in the road for those that want to take issue with it or think it's all, you know, a bit of a confusing hodgepodge. Mm-hmm. But certainly we weren't hearing too much about Pleiadians before 1975 when Billy first started to...
Well, that's right. That's where it came from.
And indeed it is. So these are the things, again, that are speculative and debatable, and I don't rest anything on them. There's a lot in the case that I couldn't prove at this point, you know, to save my life. I don't know. There's things in here that I've disagreed with. There's things in here that I'm confounded by, you know, just... I don't know. It's neither been proved nor disproved at this point, and so I say it's speculation.
Why have you been named the official authorized American media representative for Billy?
Well,
what's up with that?
Well, probably one of the reasons is I stepped up to the plate because I want to do this work. I had originally, in 1979, I got the book, and I was like everybody else that had that book, fascinated by the photos. In 1986, I was sitting in a little cafe in Sedona, Arizona, with my daughter and a friend. I think it's called the Sunflower Cafe, or it was. We were waiting for our alfalfa, you know, sandwiches with sprouts, like everybody was in the New Age. And there was one other guy in the place, and he's sitting back there. So we started to chat with him, and he was a retired IRS agent. And, of course, the talk went in the direction of UFOs and all, and Billy Meyer case came up, and he said, well, have you read the contact reports? And I said, what's that? And he says, well, that's all those conversations, you know, in the picture book. I said, yeah. He says, you know those quotes in the side panels from these extraterrestrials? I said, yeah. He says, well, there's 2,000 pages of that. So I said, well, where do I get it? He said, well, when you come back to L.A., come on up to, you know, Decker Canyon, I think it's called, and I'll give it to you. I came back. I called him. He was true to his word. He gave me all this material. And for weeks on end, I was up reading it, fascinated. And it took a long time also because it was kind of strange, you know, backwards English from Swiss German somewhere.
Yes.
And what was exciting about it was that there were all of these pieces of information being conversationally conveyed. And what we were missing in these contact reports was this, what I call hokey thing of, we're the Space Brothers, and we bring you love and light. And
You know,
they never spoke that way. And interestingly enough, in reading of the several thousand pages I've read of the Mayan...
Let me stop you and ask you, how, if they didn't speak that way, how did they speak?
They spoke logically and precisely. It wasn't without warmth. They greeted each other with friendliness. It, for the longest time, there wasn't much of a sense of humor present in it. Billy exhibited his own humor, and they didn't quite get it for the longest time, quite literally. But they spoke directly, and what I was going to say is the only time I ever saw in print any of these ETs use the word, the two words, I believe. There was one occasion I can remember when the man that is, you know, supposedly a leader of their race, who's called Ptah, same name as the ancient Egyptian god, he said to Billy, I believe the person you're thinking of is named such and such. Other than that, they only spoke of what they knew and what they didn't know.
All right, let's get to the why of it. Why Billy Meyer, for example, instead of the head of Switzerland or the head of the United States, president or, you know, Russia or whatever,
sure.
Why not a world leader? Why
this man?
Why a Swiss guy living a rural lifestyle? Why him?
Well, there's actually a host of reasons, but let me say that in addition to Billy, there were five other people who were selected as potentially being able to do this quote-unquote mission. They either declined or died or killed in car accidents or what have you. There were a total of six people. Meyer was one and probably the main candidate. And the reason, and I'm just going to tell it, again, this is going to be speculative, so for anybody who wants to scratch their head around this point. These people have conveyed in the material that reincarnation is a fact of life. I like to say there's a bumper sticker that would say, reincarnation, don't worry about dying, you'll live through it. So they kind of hold this philosophy, we live millions of times, we have no recall for the most part of any of these experiences, and what we do is come back time and time and time again to evolve, to learn new lessons. Mm. And they claim to have the ability to track that essential part that reincarnates, that they call the human spirit, not the soul, but the human spirit.
They call it the human spirit.
The human spirit. In other words, the spirit or spirit form, they use that term, you know, the spirit form or the human spirit. That's the individually unique essence of every human living every and anywhere on Earth or anywhere in this universe.
Same thing a priest would say.
Could be, except they might call it the soul. But they claim that the soul is a different thing. It's located in the solar plexus. They say this is akin to the psyche, and there may be very distinct differences in their cosmology between the soul and the spirit. The soul does not survive the dying process, but the spirit does. This is, again, according to them. So this isn't to pass on, you know, create a new belief system here. This is information. It's speculative. But
you know what? It would tend to create a new belief system. I mean, if people – in fact, I've actually heard that at the Meyer Farm or compound or whatever it is called these days, there's almost a cult-like, you know, atmosphere surrounding Billy.
In my three, you know, visits there so far yearly – I have not only not observed it as a cult-like following around him, I've had the pleasure and privilege of watching them fight with each other and yell and be very human and go about their business, quite literally. I don't mean physically fight, but...
When you say fight with each other, do you mean the Meyer family or the Meyer following?
I mean, Meyer argues with people, and they argue with him. The people there are, how can I put it, you know, these are European people, Swiss, rural for the most part, very down-to-earth people. They don't have much pretense.
Yes, but still, there is a rather large group that follows Meyer, isn't there?
Not really.
No. There's not.
No, I'll tell you more. I mean, in terms of the actual numbers of the core group around him, and they don't
Okay, so there is a core group around him. That's what I'm getting at.
Meaning that there's 49 people that are affiliated as people who study the teachings and the case and are associated with each other. They don't all live together or anything like that.
All right, Michael, hold tight. So it's not some big commune. You know, there's a lot of rumors that were out there about Meyer and the whole thing. From the high desert in the middle of the night with a full moon hanging right over all of us, This is Coast to Coast AM. Don't touch that dial.
Out on the street, I was talking to a man. He said, so much, but there's nothing mine that I don't understand. You shouldn't worry, I said that.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
My guest is Michael Horn, who is now the officially authorized American media representative for Billy Meier. Billy Meier is the Swiss man who's probably been the recipient of, it was once called, the Palladian information, and more clear photographs, we'll ask about that, there really are clear photographs of UFOs, the clearest photographs actually ever taken. There are people who believe the whole case was a hoax, but I think many more who don't. In a moment, we'll get right back to it, Billy Meier. Once again, Michael Horn for Billy Meier, actually. Michael, what is the best proof offered that Billy Meier and the UFOs, Billy Meier's real, but the UFOs really exist? I mean, was there any, of course there are the photographs. How many in totality?
It is said that Billy took upwards of 1,200 photos in about a three-year period.
Right.
Enormous number. And, you know, Art, when you think about this, this is either going to turn out to be, and people have to determine for themselves, the greatest hoax in all of human history, or hands down, simply the most important story. There's really...
It's one of the two, yes.
Yeah, there's no middle ground. If this is real, if it's true, it's the most important story, and then we're going to find out why it's happening and what people are... And what are we supposed to do with this information? But I'm going to address what you've just raised, and that would be,
proof.
The proof. So let's start with the idea that there's about, I think, five categories of physical evidence.
All right.
And the five categories would be photographs,
mm-hmm.
films, a video that we know of, one video, sound recordings that were made on a cassette machine, and also a number of metal alloy samples, little squiggles of metal that Meier claims were given to him by the ETs. They were turned over to the investigative team along with the other evidence.
With what result?
Well, this is the fascinating thing on the evidence. And what I should do is just back it up a little bit and say that Meier's evidence and the process around it is unique because it was actually examined by a good number of scientific experts in a variety of fields.
Mm-hmm.
I will give you just a reference point. In terms of photographs, there were people like Robert Post from JPL Laboratory, 22 years at the lab. Michael Mallon from Mars Orbiter and NASA Mars Global Surveyor, the Mallon Space Science System.
I know of him well.
Okay.
Yes, of course.
They were two of the people. Jim Della Toso, there's a 23-page report on the actual physical examination.
And what did Michael Malin conclude?
Actually, I have a quote from him.
All right, good.
And he said, I find the photographs themselves credible. They're good photographs. They appear to represent a real phenomenon. The story that some farmer in Switzerland is on a first-name basis with dozens of aliens who come to visit him, I find that incredible.
Oh, well, so do I.
Yeah.
But from Malin, that's quite a statement. Because...
Well, he goes on. He says, but I find the photographs more credible. They're reasonable evidence of something. What that something is, I don't know. If the photographs are hoaxes, then I am intrigued by the quality of the hoax. How did he do it? I'm always interested in seeing a master at work. Now, let's just jump, since we're talking about people that looked at the photos, there was a man whose name was Wally Gentleman, and Wally was apparently a major player in the special effects world in films. He was the director of special effects on the Canadian Film Board. He was the director of special photographic effects for Kubrick's 2001. He had seen Meyer's 8mm film segments.
Right.
And he said that the manpower and the costs to make these films were clearly beyond Meyer's reach. Here was his quote. He said, my greatest problem is that for anybody faking this, and he was referring to the photographs,
yes,
the shadow that is thrown onto that tree is correct. Therefore, if somebody is faking it, they have an expert there. And being an expert myself, I know that that expert knowledge is very hard to come by. So I say, well, is that expert knowledge there or isn't it there? Because if the expert knowledge isn't there, this has got to be real. Now, that's just...
Well, that's still a hell of a statement from Malin. That's surprising.
Well, no, this was Wally Gentleman.
I understand. I'm still stuck
on
back on Malin's statement.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, you know, now look, there. Robert Post, he said from a photography standpoint, you couldn't see anything that was fake about the Meyer photos. That's what struck me. They looked like legitimate photographs. I thought, God, if this is real, this is going to be really something. Now, he was with the JPL Photo Lab for 22 years. He was the head of that lab in 1979. He oversaw the developing and printing of every photograph that came out of JPL at the time. Now, we'll get into this with skeptics and all, but when you have these...
Well, I'll give you one right now,
okay.
A skeptic, somebody from FNET. I think that's Crosshatch Art Bell up there on the net, Fargo, North Dakota, says his ex-wife has come out to denounce him as a fraud.
Okay, yes, of course.
The evidence is overwhelming that the whole Billy Meyer story is unquestionably, absolutely, completely, and totally 100% bogus, case closed.
Right. Well, let's visit the story of the ex-wife.
All right, let's.
And let's go back to the original investigation when Wendell Stevens, Lee Elders and Britt Elders and Tom Welch and other people went over to Switzerland, and they actually spent a total of 6 years investigating the case. They interviewed, I believe it was 15 or 16 people, including Meyer and his wife, and they put these 15 or 16 people separately through lie detector tests. During this process, all of the people came out as truthful.
Mm-hmm.
The questions involved, did Mr. Meyer see spaceships? Had anybody else there seen the spaceships? Mrs. Meyer passed the lie detector test saying she'd seen them. And
all right, well then, what happened?
Well,
I mean,
you know what? Here's the beauty of the Meyer case. It conforms to one of my dearly held axioms or principles about life. Wherever human beings are involved, things can and will get screwed up.
Yeah.
So Meyer is a human being, and his wife's a human being. After 30 years of marriage or whatever it was, they are fighting with each other, and they got divorced. And a lot of this is in the contact reports. I mean, you would hear about all this stuff. You could read about it. She's had no sense of privacy left. The world is traipsing through her living room, literally. Her family is, you know, she's trying to raise a family.
Well, I'm sure all of that is true.
You know, and...
But did she...
And she came out afterwards, after they separated the divorce, and said, oh, it's all a fake. He faked it. Unfortunately for her, there's a recording and a video of her talking about the ships and the reality of the whole case prior to that. So what we have to say here is, I don't rest the proof of the case on simply what Billy Meyer says or ex-Mrs. Meyer says. There are higher standards, but I want to present that so the people can look at this. I give you a couple photographic experts. Let's just for a second go to this, and then maybe the guy who knows that this case is a big hoax, maybe he'll have an answer for this, and maybe also what he'll do is attempt to do what the professional skeptics have attempted and failed to do after 3 years, and that's to duplicate any of the evidence. So let me quote a little bit here. I told you that metal samples had been turned over to Marcel Vogel at IBM.
Correct, yes.
Okay. A little background. At the time, he had been a research chemist for IBM. He'd been there 22 years. He held 32 patents himself. He'd invented the magnetic disk coding memory system that apparently up until recently, if not still currently, is used in the IBM disk memories. He was a specialist in the conversion of energy inside crystals.
All right. Okay. Having said all that, he's so obviously an expert. What did he find?
All right. Well, he turns on his $250,000 scanning electron microscope. He turns on the video camera, and he starts to apply a probe, a stainless steel probe, to this metal sample. Now, I'll quote him. "When I touched the oxide with a stainless steel probe, red streaks appeared, and the oxide coating disappeared. I just touched the metal like that, and it started to deoxidize.
Where are you getting this quote from?
This was written by, not written by, but in Gary Kinder's book, Light Years. He published a letter called An Open Letter to the UFO Community, wherein he had quoted a number of these experts that he personally interviewed, and he sent all the interviews to them for approval before they were published. So nobody's come back and said, "I didn't say
that." All right, so that's pretty remarkable.
Well, that's just
he
the
touched
beginning.
It. Yeah, continue, please.
Okay.
The oxide disappears.
Yeah, he says it started to deoxidize and become a pure metal. "I have never seen a phenomenon like that before." Then he's talking about another metal sample that contained nearly every element in the periodic table, and he says each pure element was bonded to each of the others, yet somehow retained its own identity. At 500 power magnification, thulium was revealed. And he says, "Thulium exists only in minute amounts. It's exceedingly expensive, far beyond platinum and rare to come by. Someone would have to have an extensive metallurgical knowledge even to be aware of a composition of this type." Hmm. At 1600 power, Vogel says, "a whole new world appears in the specimen. They're structures within structures, very unusual." At 2,500 power, he found that the metal sample was metal, but at the same time, it's crystal. And so he summarizes his findings. This, of course, is maybe an hour-long analysis. He says, "With any technology that I know of, we could not achieve this on this planet." And I think that it is important that those of us who are in the scientific world sit down and do some serious study on these things instead of putting it off as people's imagination. He also said,
I must admit, that is impressive.
It's dynamite. Plus, he said he brought in a metallurgist friend of his and showed him the samples, and the guy said, "Hey, I don't know how this could be put together." Now, there's another very high-level scientist whose name is David Froning, and he had been with McDonnell Douglas for 25 years as an astronautical engineer in highly classified military defense. In 79, he became interested in Meyer's accounts of this of the Pleiaren starship systems, which mentioned tachyon propulsion. And Froning found that Meyer's account of tachyon propulsion, which was at the time only beginning to be discussed by a very small and select group of theoretical physicists, that the calculations for above light speed that Meyer published were amazing. There's a whole thing here in the piece by our friend Gary Kinder, and what David Froning is saying is that let me see if I can just find a thing here where he says that my colleagues and I may have made breakthroughs in our understanding of possibilities and ways for traveling faster than light from Billy Meyer's accounts of his encounters with the Pleiarens. Now that's from a guy who publishes high-level papers on quantum ramjet performance and quantum interstellar ramjet stuff that I have no conception of whatsoever. And the calculations that Meyer had, here he says, Meyer said that the elapsed time during a hyperspace jump took only several seconds, thus trip time between the Pleiades star cluster and Earth with Froning's slower-than-light quantum ramjet drive, plus a hypothetical tachyon drive would be 8.6 hours, which was within 20% of the Pleiaren trip time reported by Meyer. But while Froning's calculations were based on many arbitrary assumptions, and they didn't prove or disprove the truthfulness of Meyer's account because it was a theoretical system that he was working on, only time's going to tell which of them were right. But he was startled by the computations being within 20%.
That is remarkable. Listen, a number of skeptics have tried to duplicate the Meyer evidence, right?
Yes.
And what do you know about that?
I know
what efforts have been made and how much success?
Yes. Well, this has been my pet project for a little while here. 3 years ago, I took a reel of the Meyer films that were on video and that lovely picture book that many of us have, and I went over to visit some fine fellows at a place called CFI West, Center for Inquiry West. And Center for Inquiry is an international professional skeptics organization. I met with a case investigator named Mr. Vaughn Reese, a very nice gentleman, and he and I went over the films and photographs, and he told me that they were all easily duplicated hoaxes. He took the time to explain.
Of course.
Yeah, of course. That the film, one film segment where in broad daylight, Meyer zooms in on a ship where you can see the flanging, and if there were any bolts on it, you could see them, and two lights alternate in broad daylight, off one off the cupola and one off of the flange rim. And Mr. Reese told me this was easy to do with a pin on a negative. So I said, look, why don't you do me a favor and spare me a lot of embarrassment? Prove your case by duplicating one of these, you know, films here.
And
3 years passed by, and during the first few months of that time, I was in touch with Mr. Reese, and I was waiting for developments, and I made a little boo-boo. I have to admit it. I've been called on the carpet for this by one of the people who's an expert in this. And what I did is I extended to Mr. Reese the opportunity, since he was having trouble duplicating any of this stuff, to go ahead and use computers, special effects, models, anything he wanted, but just to try and do it all with one hand, since Meyer is a man with only one arm. Well, I then published an article where I simply said, professional skeptics group proves UFOs are real, because they had failed after 3 years to submit any evidence.
Mm-hmm.
This was picked up and written about in the national tabloid called The Sun. And The Sun, I'm not a man who would usually quote a tabloid, but they did probably the cleanest report on this without sensationalizing. They didn't have President Bush meeting with little gray guys up on Meyer's farm. And they concurred that based on this, the evidence and the photos and the obviousness, that these skeptics had failed to make the case. So suddenly, they did send me a notice that they had now posted six photographs next to some of Meyer's photographs to compare. And they actually did nice photographs of models of UFOs floating. That there were some problems with it, and we've engaged in a lengthy debate, and I'll explain to you exactly what the problems were. They thought that duplicating the photos for some reason meant hang a model by a string or float it with helium, whatever, and take a photograph of it where you can't really make out any details on it and where there's no physical objects next to it whereby you can compare the size.
Hmm.
Now, this is extremely important. Because,
well, that would not be consistent with the Meyer photographs.
Not at all. Because in the Meyer photographs,
you've got a lot of trees and mountains and reference points for the photographs in the with Meyer.
Exactly. Plus, you've got multiple UFOs. You have sequence shots where the ships move across the sky, maybe three or four ships, and then they're in, you know, each shot.
Look, folks, there's no question about this. The photographic evidence in the Meyer case is the most impressive, detailed, sharp, clear, all of that, and then with Malin's statement. So anyway.
Yeah, well, I'll give you the rest on this, because people have to know. I mean, the skeptics, this is the problem with the professional skeptics, one of them. They're not scientists. They set out with a premise that something is false, and they try to prove the premise. Now, they don't try to objectively find out what are we looking at. They tell you right away it's a hoax, and we can prove it. It's a hoax, not we can discover what it is. So, when they did these photographs, and I and Jim Deardorff and other people have called them to task on it, and they're trying to say that they duplicated. So I said, well, fulfill the rest of the duplication process and submit them for photographic analysis. Well, they refused to respond to that.
Why?
Because all you're going to see, probably you're going to have a model of, you know, whatever determinant size. It's certainly not going to be a 21-foot in diameter, fully metallic, self-supporting craft. And they know that. And so then they say that I refuse to submit any real evidence for examination. Well, here's the problem with that. On the website, we have the sounds of the ships
right.
that Meyer and his wife recorded in an open field.
I've heard it.
Yeah, it's there. And it was so booming and so loud that 15 witnesses came from around the countryside, including a plainclothes policeman. And the recording actually lasts, the full recording lasts over 40 minutes. The snippet we have on the website is probably about 3 minutes long. Now, here's the beauty of this, and we even now on my articles page, we've posted an overview of the sound analysis on this. They could not. This was taken to two different sound labs, and there are, I can give you the skinny on the people who were analyzing
what
it.
What did the sound lab say?
Oh, okay. I'll bring that right here, and I'll kind of give you guys a little overview. And then anybody that wants, they can, you know, read the full thing. But here's what basically what they said was, and let's see if I can zoom down. Basically, they found that there were 32 or more discrete frequencies in a random and constantly shifting mix that ranged from 4 to 2170 hertz, but varied on average between 470 and 1452 hertz, almost okay, won't worry about that. The amplitude of the frequencies was also constantly changing, whereby the dominance altered. And then I go on to talk about the wave shape and all this stuff. Basically, what they're saying was, with any technology, including synthesizers, they could not duplicate the sounds. And part of what was remarkable in these constantly shifting and interfacing sounds was 24 of them were in the audible range, 8 of them could only be detected with spectrum analyzers and oscilloscopes. These were recorded outdoors with birds chirping and crickets in an open field, yet you had 24 audible sounds, 8 of the sounds were a frequency range that you could only see the patterns of them or pick them up on that kind of technology.
All right, all right. Hold it right there, Michael. We're at the top of the hour. So we've got extremely high-quality photographs that can't be duplicated. We've got little pieces of metal that have been tested and shown to be alien of some kind, and we've got sound that's been dissected by some of the best and found to be very complex in the manner you just heard. My guest is Michael Horn.
Can some people...